tonight on Arena. A new documentary on how to treat the subjects of documentary films and how London was an inspirational force for the young William Butler Yeats. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Remember when everyone was hooked on The Staircase, the true crime documentary which had us all wondering if the novelist husband of Kathleen Peterson, the woman who was found dead at the bottom of her stairs, was guilty of her murder? That husband, Michael Peterson, having been charged with Kathleen's murder, allowed a documentary team to film what happened next, as he didn't trust the judicial system to give him a fair trial. In this clip from The Staircase, Michael Peterson describes the last time he saw Kathleen alive.
And then what we would usually do on a nice night, we would go down to the pool, which I always, you know, think is about the nicest place on the property. I don't know if the chairs were like this or not, but I mean, they're, you know, probably something like this. And she was, we were both right here. And, you know, the dogs would come over and we were just talking and finishing our drinks. And then she said, I gotta go in, because I've got the conference call in the morning. And she started walking out that way. And I stayed right here. Don't think I say anything special to her, certainly not thinking this is the, you know, last time I'm gonna see her. I said, good night, I'll be up a little bit later. And I stayed here, and she walked. And the last I saw her was when I was there, and she was just walking here. That's it. That was the last I saw Kathleen alive. No, she was alive when I found her, but barely.
Michael Peterson there in a clip from The Staircase. He may have been eager to involve the documentary crew in his case, but what about the rest of his family, including his 20-year-old adopted daughter, Margaret Ratcliffe, who, consumed by grief and fearing her father might get the death penalty, also found herself taking part? A new documentary on the morals of documentary making called Subject explores the effect the constant intrusion of film crews into these lives of vulnerable and distressed people can have, including Margaret from The Staircase, as well as participants in such well-known documentaries as Hoop Dreams, Capturing the Freedmans and The Square. I'm joined from the US this evening by one of the co-directors of Subject, Jennifer Teixeira. Jennifer, great to have you with us this evening. Yourself and Camilla Hall's look at the ethics really of documentary making in your film Subject. What was it specifically that prompted you to make this film?
Sure. Well, Camilla and I met back in 2017 at the Tribeca Film Festival, and we had quite different backgrounds. At that point in my career, I had been a documentary film editor for about 15 years. And so I found myself in these situations where I would spend all this time with these participants. I'd spend, you know, some films, 700 hours of footage. Another film I put together had about 1,000 hours. So I would end up falling in love with these people and these communities, but without really ever knowing their true hopes and dreams for the project. I never actually had even met them. And I found myself in a situation where the better I did my job, and sometimes the more sensational I could make a story, the more I would question the ethics and what really they wanted out of the project. And that's really what led to me producing and then ultimately directing, so I could have those one-on-ones from the very beginning and form a bit more of a collaboration. And then with Camilla, she had come from a long career as a journalist. And when she entered the documentary sphere, was very, I guess, just blown away by the lack of resources and real guidelines. You know, she'd always had an editor and all these like very strict rules to follow as a journalist, and really kind of realized if you had the money, you could really make whatever documentary project you wanted without a lot of checks and balances.
So your film then, Subject, opens with, one could argue, the most sensational of all of these, or one of the most sensational of all of these documentary series that had been on the go at the time, the story of Margaret Ratcliffe. She, the daughter of Kathleen and Michael Peterson, the Subject family of The Staircase. She talks about how painful the whole process was. Maybe you would just remind us of that series, The Staircase, and Margaret's role in it.
Yeah, well, Margaret was, she was in college, actually, when her father was accused of killing her stepmother. And, her mother. That was definitely, that was her mother role. And when she came home, I think that's what struck us so interesting about Margie, is that this really could have, happened to anybody, where you're a kid, you're at school, come home from college, and all of a sudden there's a film crew there, and it's like, okay, this is happening, and you're willing to do anything to help your parents, and that's exactly what she did. So, it was, Margaret was Margie. We actually shouldn't go by Margaret. Margie was instrumental in helping us develop the film. It was actually, she had reached out to Camilla through a mutual friend, because she actually majored in documentary filmmaking and was wondering what Camilla was working on and thought maybe she could work on one of her films. And when Camilla floated this idea of us wanting to deep dive into what it meant to be a participant, she thought, she gave it some thought and really thought she could contribute to the conversation. Now, at this point in her life, she's been on the other side of the camera for 24 years. And then what ended up happening after was just, no one could have predicted it. The Staircase series went from the Sundance Channel to Netflix into over 200 countries, and then ultimately was turned into a fictional series on HBO Max. It really just took on a life of its own.
Let's listen to Margie then in Subject, where she's reacting to that final thing you mentioned there, that when it became this limited series on HBO Max, so a dramatic version of the story that had already been told so widely in documentary form.
So the latest is that HBO Max is now making a series based on the Staircase documentary.
Family is all we got. We're not perfect. God knows.
It's still hitting me, that this is actually happening. Ugh, it's so gross. Colin Firth is playing my dad. It's a star-studded cast. I do know Sophie Turner from Game of Thrones is playing me. That's when I found that out, I thought, this is going to be a thing. This is going to be a thing that people bother me about, and that's going to make my life harder. And the director even emailed me and said, Sophie Turner wants to speak with you about the role. And I thought, so you want me to talk about the most traumatic points in my life, that I have spent decades in trauma therapy over, with an actress who then gets paid to play me? That's not right.
There we have a clip from the documentary film Subject with Margie Ratcliffe there, talking about how she felt about the making of the drama series around what had been a documentary series before that. It's the film Subject that I'm speaking about, co-directed by Margaret Teixeira, who's with me on the phone. Jennifer, I beg your pardon, Teixeira, who's on the phone with me this evening. I mean, you really hear the pain in her voice there, Jennifer, in terms of how this was all being revisited again. And of course, one of my first questions was going to be to you, how did you persuade her to be a subject in this particular documentary? But you've explained that she very much wanted to be part of it. What about going back to Michael Peterson, her father, the man accused with the murder of his wife? You got him to take part in Subject. Was that a difficult task?
I think, Margie's commitment to the project, I think was really instrumental, and not only Michael taking part, but also the other participants. I think, you know, especially Jesse Friedman, you know, that they had lived a lot of common experiences. And it could be very isolating to participate in one of these projects, especially, you know, in a situation that revolves around true crime or something of that nature. So I think it was really Margie's participation that, you know, allowed Michael yeah. to comfortably sign on, as well as Jesse. And, you know, Margie had a lot of ups and downs. Like, you know, one thing that we really wanted to explore in making Subject was the idea of continued consent, like this idea of constantly revisiting the idea of consent and what it means at each part of the way. And there was times where, you know, Margie wanted a producer role and she wanted to be more behind the camera, which we welcomed because, you know, neither Camille and I had ever been a participant. So we wanted to really rely on, you know, they had agency over their story. We wanted to hear from them. We had so much to learn from them.
Yeah, it is interesting that many of the subjects of your documentary are, in fact, credited as co-producers in the final credits. But just going back to Capturing the Friedmans there, you mentioned Jesse Friedman. This was the story that was told in that documentary was an investigation of the father and son, Arnold and Jesse Friedman, for child molestation. Andrew Jarecki was the documentary maker in that case. Did he set out, do you know and do you think, with the purpose of finding, establishing Jesse Friedman's innocence?
I couldn't answer that question. That is absolutely a question for Andrew. The only thing I could say is I know that Andrew has been extremely involved in all of Jesse's appeals and everything else regarding Jesse's court cases from, you know, to this day. I think we do refer to that. We touch on that in Subject. What his actual intentions were, I can't.
Yeah, it certainly was the outcome. But there were other unforeseen consequences, perhaps for the Friedman family in the midst of all of this as well.
Yeah, I think that nobody can really, you know, I don't think we can ever predict the future. But what I think we can do is really have some serious conversations about transparency on what could potentially happen. And I think we also need to look at something called consent under duress. You know, when you have a situation where it's life or death, you know, or if it's like saving a family member, these are situations where it's like, how much real value does that little piece of paper, you know, the release hold in those situations?
Yeah,
and so these are just some of the things that
you're
we kind of want to open
because
discussing, yeah, exactly.
Jesse talks about, you know, when they were at Sundance, how people walked across to the other side of the street to avoid him on the street. And his mother is very angry about the depiction of her in the film. I mean, it gets down to this point of view of the duty of care of the documentary maker and also what say the subject should have in the final product. It's a difficult one to answer.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really interesting, I think there's no one size fits all. That's the one thing that we've been able to take away from all of this. Documentary is a huge genre, and there's a dozen different, you know, ways that you can, millions of different ways that you can handle it. I think it's really important to be deliberate at every step of the process, transparent, lots of conversation, and those things take time. In this situation, with Subject in particular, this was not their first rodeo. These were all very experienced participants. So it made sense for them to have as much creative control as they did.
Yeah.
It was really about them having agency over their story. Do I recommend that for all documentary films? I absolutely not. But in this case, it
made sense. It's certainly a very thought-provoking film. And thanks very much, Jennifer, for sharing your thoughts with us about it this evening. That's Jennifer Teixeira, co-director of the film, the documentary film Subject. And Subject is available on demand from iTunes, Google, Amazon, and all of the usual digital platforms later in the month. Now, when we think of the hinterland of William Butler Yeats, our imaginations will most likely bring us to the west of Ireland, Sligo specifically, I would have thought, and its rugged landscape. But a new artistic project and walking trail is encouraging people to explore the deep connection between the Irish poet and the West London suburb of Bedford Park, where he lived with his family for much of his youth. The area inspired many of his most beautiful poems, including, surprisingly, The Lake Isle of Innisfree. It was in Bedford that Yeats first encountered his great muse Maud Gonne, and through connections there, forged there, his poetry was published. Also, it was there that he got many of the ideas around his theatrical exploits. A new smartphone poetry trail around the area celebrates the work of W.B. Yeats. It's narrated by none other than Oscar nominee and friend of the programme, Ciarán Hinds. The W.B. Yeats Bedford Artwork Project is the brainchild of Ballycastle poet and Bedford Park resident Cathal Dallet, who joins me now live on this World Poetry Day. So Bedford Park, you're telling us now, Cathal, are going to claim W.B. Yeats as their one and only, no, not their only, their own very own poem, poet, and poor old Sligo can step to the one side.
Oh, far from it. And the wonderful thing about all of this is that it is a recognition, I think, by English people, by Londoners, by people involved in arts and culture and so on, of how vital the links with, how much Irish literature or Irish writers have been part of English literature. So that it's very much a two-way process. In the process, I mean, for me and my great-grandparents are from Sligo. I'm from the Glens of Antrim, as it happens. So, but I've been in London many years, and I've constantly been pointing out to people how much what we call English literature is written by Irish people. I just happen to live a couple of blocks away from where John Butler Yeats decided to bring up his family. I brought up my family there and then started preaching the message. And actually, the more you look at it, the more you see how involved he was with everything locally. And that's been a really big exploration.
Absolutely. And to be fair, I was being a little bit facetious, clearly, but what you're talking about in terms of Bedford Park is how formative it was, in fact, in the young Yeats' mind and in his artistic expression. Bedford Park was the first garden suburb. What do we mean by that?
Well, I mean, it was founded by a Dublin man called Jonathan Carr, who was from an artistic family. His brother, Joseph Commons Carr, ran the Grosvenor Gallery in London, and his sister, Kathleen Commons Carr, was a painter. But Jonathan got this idea that because the tube train or the railway train was now coming out of London into this country village called Chiswick, that if he got a bit of land there and built houses that would appeal to artists. Well, how do you build houses that appeal to artists? Well, the arts and crafts movement under William Morris was really moving forward. And so they built these Queen Anne style houses, and he got his brother to get them all rented to loads of artists, writers, playwrights, set designers, publishers, etc. And John Butler Yeats heard about it, living in Victorian London, in Kensington, in those high houses that I'm sure everybody knows, with a basement and an attic, you know. And this place was all villas with their own little gardens, you know, and picket fences. And it was just a dream. And it was John Butler Yeats, his wife Susan Pollockson, was never that happy in London, but this was like moving out to the country again.
Yeah,
of course, it's far from being in the country now, but that's what it meant then.
That's what it meant back then. And in the 1870s, the sort of people, as you've half described to us there, that were living in the neighbourhood, it really was a real collection. It was almost like an artist collective from one house to the next.
Yeah.
There was a painter, there were poets, there were all sorts of artists involved.
Oh, We had Ukrainian anarchists then. We had Sergei Stepniak, who, of course, co-edited Russia Today with Lily Voynich, who was from Cork. And people will know Ethel Boole because Alana Hopkins has written about her. But it was full of people, Irish people, Ukrainians, an Asian MP. People often don't know that there were Asian MPs in Westminster Parliament in the 1880s and so on. An American abolitionist who then introduced Buddhist speakers into the local Bedford Park Club. Theatrical people, George Bernard Shaw's leading lady, Florence Farr, her sister lived in Bedford Park, so she spent some time there. And of course, that was a big moment for Yeats once he met her. But it was all these different, he lived next door to Elkin Matthews, who ran the Bodley Head and published the Yellow Book. So whenever he put in his poems, you know, a rejection would be very difficult for an editor, you know, if John Butler Yeats lived next door and said, "You didn't take my son's poem," you know. So they were really well connected, you know.
Yeah,
and of course, W.E. Henley lived just down the road in Chiswick.
Was it through Florence Farr that he met Annie Horniman, who, of course, was very important in terms of the establishment of the Abbey?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of steps there, but there's another Irish poet, John Todhunter, living in a road called The Orchard here. They've all very fanciful names. And Todhunter has written a play, and Yeats gets very excited because Florence Farr is going to be delivering the lines in the local little amateur theatre. So he falls in love with Florence Farr as an artist, I have to say, loves what she does. But he's saying to Todhunter, why don't you write an Irish play, you know? And he's already seeing the English National Theatre, the whole Shakespeare thing going on, and thinking there should be an Irish National Theatre. So Florence Farr says to him at a Christmas party in 1894, why don't you write something Irish? And my little niece here, who lived in Bedford Park, could be the fairy in that story. And Yeats says, I don't know what to do with that because I don't know much about kids. Well, as we know, he didn't marry till he was 51. But in the story, of course, there's a woman who, as he says, is in a distressed condition, as we would say, away with the fairies. And of course, Yeats' mother, when they'd moved back to Bedford Park the second time, was having a very unhappy time. And he actually sort of used that local sense of somebody who was distressed and depressed and so on to turn that into a play. Florence Farr puts it all on the West End with Annie Horniman's money. And, you know, it's only a few years from there till he meets up with Frank Fay, Willie Fay, Lady Gregory. I think a lot of people will know the rest of the story of the Abbey Theatre. But this was a magical moment.
And again, it feeds into what the app and what this whole project is about. It's about establishing those early influences that were expressed in different ways later on in his life. However, let us listen. The app, which people can get on the phone if they go specifically to the area, but we'll talk about that later on. It features the voice of Ciarán Hinds narrating the various houses that you might be walking past if you're on the walking tour, but also reading some of the poems of William Butler Yeats, including this one.
I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavements grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core.
And that's Ciarán Hinds there reading Lake Isle of Innisfree, the William Butler Yeats poem, of course, which is part of this smartphone trail, walking trail that we're speaking about this evening with Cathal Dollett from Bedford Park in Chiswick. And the presumption is, of course, I think for many people, if you say, where did Yeats write the Lake Isle of Innisfree? You say, well, he must have been looking out on a lovely lake in Sligo somewhere, mustn't he? Looking at all of these things and seeing them in front of his eyes. I think to explain this one to us, Cathal, you'll have to tell us about Chiswick 8.
Right. And that sounds like a postcode like Dublin 4, but it's not.
It
is spelled EYOT, which is the old Anglo-Saxon word for an island. And there's a little island or islet, like ISLET, an islet in the Thames. And Yeats, both between 1879 and 1881, when the family were there first, they then went back to Dublin, then they came back to Chiswick in London in 1887, got another house in Bedford Park and stayed there till 1900. But Yeats was very fond of walking by the river because that's one of the reasons for moving out to Chiswick, you know? And so he went to this particular place quite a lot. And if you actually look at it on the app, you can see two pictures. And in fact, it looks quite like Lochgill, where it's nowhere near as high. Mm. And in fact, in Chiswick, you can walk out to it at low tide. So he would go and spend time there. And it would remind him of being at Lochgill when he was a kid, when he'd go to his grandparents in Sligo. And in fact, it was more than just going for summer holidays, because of course when the Yeatses ran out of money, they often sent the kids home to their grandparents to survive for a little while, or back to Dublin and so on. So it was all his childhood memories. This is a young man of 22 coming back to Chiswick again, going to this island in the river and thinking, I've always had this dream of Lough Gill. So the poem's absolutely about Innisfree and Lough Gill, but it's inspired by walking up and down the river. In fact, he's got a novel called John Sherman written that summer about a young man from the west of Ireland who is in London living with his mother and is very unhappy. And he describes walking up and down the banks of the river at night and so on. And then he talks about having spent a whole day dreaming there. And we know that he walked a few hundred yards home from there, went to his upstairs bedroom at number 3 Blenheim Road, Bedford Park, and actually came down a few hours later and said to his sisters, look at this great poem I've got. Oddly, they weren't immediately impressed, but that happens with great art, I think, quite a lot. He eventually showed the poem to W.E. Henley, who was a neighbour, but also happened to be the editor of the National Observer, and he published that, and suddenly Yeats was a success. I mean, not all in that one poem, of course, but yeah, it's a story about one place reminds you of another rather than that you have to be at that place to write the poem. Yeah, so that's kind of the...
It's not so much that the island in Chisagate inspired the poem, but it reminded him of what he had seen as a child. So it's about the longing for that place that he now misses.
But of course, what one often says of artists that they have to go away, as James Joyce did, you have to go away to write about all the places that you're missing. And so Yeats is a classic example of that. Although, of course, many of his other poems, his love poems and so on, are of somebody he was in love with immediately, like Maud Gonne, whom he fell in love with at the door, when she came to the door of Bedford Park, and also of their house. So it's a real mix, but that's one particularly, is the world's greatest poem of exile, and was written when he was, quote, in exile, although it's where he'd done a lot of his growing up. Yeah. So it's a real mixed story.
Yeah. You know, we mentioned, obviously, Yeats, and he was a Nobel Prize winner. It would seem that this particular area of Chiswick is awash with Nobel Prize winners and international artists, or was awash.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is another whole project called the Chiswick Timeline, which lists all the writers who've lived here, and that's Chiswick. The distinction I make, I think, is that writers have always come to London, haven't they? And we know that all those great Irish writers, Shaw and Wilde and Boucicault and Goldsmith and Sheridan and all came to London. The Yeats kind of grew up here, so he's slightly different. So anybody can come to London, get a bit of success and maybe buy a house in Bedford Park or some nice area. But in fact, Yeats grew up there and sort of was fired by it. And it's that mix of a London that's full of writers and artists. That's great. But you need to have the Irish inspiration, the love of the West of Ireland, landscape, lore, legends, language, everything. And to bring that into the melting pot, if you like, the crucible that is somewhere like Bedford Park, where people can then tell you how to get your play put on, how to get your poems published. And that's what a capital city does. Of course, it's what any capital city does. But then London was the capital of, quote, the United Kingdom, as was. And so people had some success in Dublin, would go on to London. And that's where John Butler Yeats decided he would be better off as a portrait painter. Not always, because he kept going back to Dublin for a while and trying his hand there. And of course, he never was entirely successful as a portrait painter, but he was incredibly successful as the best talker in Bedford Park. They had these great debating societies, and John Butler Yeats was loved for his gregariousness and his wit and so on. So that's what Willie grew up with, as a kind of a buzzing atmosphere, you know.
You might be giving him a run for his money on the basis of your chat with me this evening so far.
There's a lot to talk about,
There certainly is that. Just explain then, there's a very important sculpture at the beginning of all of this in wrought light is the name of that particular artwork. Explain that to us and what's involved in that. This is from Conrad Shawcross.
Yes, well, of course, the story is very simple in a way. We had this idea that we wanted to do something that expressed Yeats's genius, if you like, rising up from Bedford Park, from the place in which it was fostered, you know? So it's almost as if it's rising up like a tree. But Conrad Shawcross was interested in science, what he calls psychogeometries, just as Yeats was interested in gyres. And, you know, when Yeats was at school here in West London, he went to a school called Godolphin, and there he was much better at physics and chemistry than he ever was at Latin and English, bizarrely, you know? So Yeats was always, in fact, Yeats understood the theory of relativity when practically nobody except Einstein did. So Yeats was interested in the unity of being that involved science and art. Conrad Shawcross has kind of come from the other way around, although his mother, the writer Marina Warner, actually delivered lectures at the Yeats Summer School last year. So he's kind of got a literary background and a fascination with art and with the mechanics of art. So this is a lots of gold and silver pieces spiraling up from the ground. There's a Purbeck stone plinth with Yeats's lines inwrought with gold and silver light, engraved in silver, the blue and the dim and the dark cloths, which everyone will know, of night and the light and the half light. This thing spirals up from the middle, and for some people it's like a flight of birds zooming up from the ground. For others it's like a Celtic hazel wood, or it's angels, you know, a flock of birds. It can be whatever you want. And Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, when he dedicated it, he talked about how what it really does is reflects all our lives to us, because every one of these panels is reflecting back, London bus going past, people walking past, kids, as great art does. Yeats's art does is reflect our lives back to us.
Yeah, and if you're in London, that is where you start this walking trail. There's a QR code there. You put your phone up and the app has all of the information.
Absolutely.
Basically sends you off on the walk, and you have narration and poems from Ciarán Hinds. And we will finish up with one of those poems, the obvious one that you've just mentioned to us there, Cathal. But thanks for being with us this evening. That's Cathal Dallett. For more information on this smartphone audio trail through Bedford Park in London, go to wbyeatsbedfordpark.com. And as I said, we'll finish with Ciarán Hinds reading the poetry of W.B. Yeats, He Wishes for the Cloths of Heaven.
Had I the heaven's embroidered cloths, inwrought with golden and silver light, the blue and the dim and the dark cloths of night and light and the half light, I would spread the cloths under your feet. But I, being poor, have only my dreams. I have spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly, because you tread on my dreams.
Ciarán Hinds there with the poetry of W.B. Yeats. And the website again for details on that smartphone audio trail, wbyeatsbedfordpark.com. God's Creatures is a film telling the story of a mother lying to protect her son and a community taking sides and shattering as a consequence. Paul Mescal plays Brian, returning home from Australia to bring his family's oyster farm back to life. His mother, Aileen, played by Emily Watson, has longed for her son to come home, and his return has blinded her to any feelings he might have. It's then revealed that one of Aileen's co-workers, Sarah, played by Aisling Franciosi, has accused Brian of sexual assault. I spoke to Paul Mescal and Emily Watson recently. Before we hear from them, let's listen to a flavour of God's Creatures.
Is Brian in? There's been a claim made by a young woman. Brian says he was at home with you that night. Is that right?
He was, yeah. We both know that's a lie, though.
This is a serious accusation.
You don't want to hear her side.
You laughed at Olive about how long?
Usual family feuds, boys being boys.
Was there anyone else out? Do you remember?
Couldn't tell you.
Everyone's got their eyes closed.
Who do you think I am at all, Mom?
Do you not feel anything about what's happened now? Is there no feeling in you?
You have this impossible image of me.
Seems like the whole world has turned upside down.
A clip there from God's Creatures. I'm delighted now to be speaking with Oscar-nominated Paul Mescal, previously twice Oscar-nominated Emily Watson. Let's talk about this film. Let's start with you, Paul, in fact. When you read it, what jumped out at you? It's an amazing story.
Well, it's just the standard of the writing and the story itself. Obviously, like Shane, I think it was a really well-formed screenplay. I think politically it was I was interested in talking about that kind of code of silence and that kind of community aspect to it that obviously Emily was going to do it. So there was a lot of no-brainers involved with why I think it was something that I would want to do.
And Brian is a character who,
looks like the nicest guy in the world. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily that.
No, absolutely not. I think there's that kind of like prodigal son, kind of Greek, biblical kind of feel to the start of the film that slowly just starts to, the screw starts to turn. And I think that's what, like without discussing around it, but like the film centers around sexual assault and a moment of that. But it's like people who commit those crimes don't necessarily walk around like in a cloak under the cover of night. They're like brothers, friends, pillars of society, you know, and I was interested in portraying that to a certain extent.
Emily, I suppose a mother, an Irish mother, her son can do no wrong, but your character, Valine, is kind of knows there's something awry here, I think. How difficult is it to rationalise, because she lies for him effectively, how difficult is it to rationalise that as the character of Valine, or do you go somewhere else rather than a rational place?
I think that's exactly it. I think she has, when he's gone out of their lives, she's lost the light of her life. She's lost the thing that makes her feel most alive, and when he comes back, she is reborn and feels love in a very intense way. And so when what he does threatens that, her instinct is entirely animal. I think she doesn't give it a second thought. She says, she lies, like, you know, it's... And I think about that scene, when I'm watching that scene, I think of myself as having yellow eyes. I don't know why.
Yeah.
It's sort of something about the lighting, but it just feels really animal moment to me. And then she is enough of a person with moral compass to begin, or she cannot ignore the evidence all around her of the implication of it and what she's done.
But the mother-son dynamic, and this is a very complicated mother-son dynamic, I suppose, every mother-son dynamic probably is. Did you do anything off the script to try to develop that relationship? I know actors can do that, but did you do anything outside of the actual text itself?
The relationship was really built by us, but also by Shane, the screenwriter, and the directors. We all talked a lot about all the history that had happened in this family and how there was a sort of intergenerational violence and that there'd been violence potentially between him and the father and that he'd left for a reason. And all of that was sort of turned up and intensified by the fact that she just loves him too much above and beyond his siblings and his dad. So it's a sort of toxic mixture.
And then that's
when
almost,
he comes back, is, you know, all those seeds have been sown.
And there's that kind of, as Paul was mentioning there, that code of silence in the community, which is really, really problematic. However, there are lots of other good things in the community. You looked very at home, I have to say, Paul, on the oyster farm.
Oh, that was when I first read the script and wanted to make the film, it was like in the COVID bubble where it was just as it was opening and I was able to, so Fola, our wonderful producer, her brother is an oyster farmer. So I went
That's
down
handy.
So it was really handy. I went down and that's a tough job. It's a lonely job. It's really labor intensive. And I think it's just,
dangerous.
It's dangerous. It's like, it's all of those things. And it was, I really enjoyed, I love when you're preparing for a film to have some sort of activity to learn. Because it's kind of preparation for free. It's just something to really throw yourself into. But I wasn't envious of, like, I remember doing the first day of it, and like here on the tops of your shoulders are just destroyed. But yeah, it was great. I loved that part
and,
of the job.
And big waders that go right up to the chest.
Yeah.
I'm guessing if water gets anywhere, it's really troublesome.
Yeah.
Now, and you do spend time in the water, Emily, as Aileen. But you had, how many fish had you gutted before film?
We had a whole day where we, because of COVID, actually, we had to have a group of extras who were, you know, in our bubble and were the same. And, you know, they had the sort of protocols all around that. And they were women, a lot of them from a fish, because we were in a very fishy part of the world, who were all experienced fish factory workers. And they taught us, what, you know, I learned to gut a salmon, fillet a mackerel. It's on my resume.
Yeah.
It's not. Additional skills.
Yeah.
And where did you learn two things? First of all, the accent.
I had a really great dialect coach. I've worked here quite a bit, and I've done other accents here, and I have a good ear, but you have to put in the hours, really. Mm-hmm. When I first got the job, I Googled the accent and came across this video. These two guys had come down off a hill and lost their sheep. And
oh, that's
just
the
went,
infamous video.
We've all seen that. Yeah.
Didn't understand a word.
On RT News.
And went sort of, what have I done?
Oh, God.
But actually, you know, if you treat it like a really scientific process and you know exactly how each syllable needs to sound and learn it like, you know, like a nursery rhyme, and then you keep going over it and over and over it, and then you can let it go, and it comes because everybody else is doing, you know, it. Is.
But you did the full Daniel Day on it. You stayed in accent, as it
I
were.
I stayed in accent. I didn't stay in character.
Yeah,
but that's different.
Yeah, absolutely. But was that essential to you? You know, because I'm sure there were others around you who had differing types of accents.
It felt essential at first, but after a while, it was completely automatic, just because. Except when I was on Zoom to my kids at home, I was...
You weren't going to give them their Irish. Well, listen, thank you both very much. Congrats on a super movie. Thanks for speaking to us this evening.
It's Paul Mescal and Emily Watson there speaking to me about God's Creatures, which will be in cinemas this Friday. We will be reviewing it on Thursday's programme. Based on Emma Walsh's novel of the same name, Apple TV's The Big Door Prize tells the story of a small town that is forever changed when a mysterious machine appears in the local shop, promising to reveal each resident's true life potential. Chris O'Dowd plays Dusty Hubbard, seemingly content, cheerful family man, high school teacher who watches everyone around him reevaluate their life choices and ambitions based on the machine's printouts. He is then forced to question whether he is truly as happy as he once thought. The community is forced to reconcile with their unfulfilled achievements in pursuit of a better future. Dave Hanratty has been watching The Big Door Prize and he's with me in studio right now. The Big Door Prize. What is The Big Door Prize?
That phrase alone kind of conjures up like game shows, I guess. Maybe American game shows of the 50s and 60s, perhaps. But the concept of a door prize is that you can win something. It's like a lottery, except usually with a kind of a social attachment. So in this situation, this is, as you've said, it's about this kind of small American community. Chris O'Dowd is our audience surrogate, to begin with, at least. It is more of an ensemble piece than you might expect going in. And essentially, everyone's kind of humdrum everyday lives are upended by this strange new science fiction arrival that occurs, offering them what may be a door prize, or what may be, in fact, a really, really anxious situation for everyone to try and get their heads around.
Yeah. There's a big... Explain what the Morpho machine is, because this is where you get your prize, your little envelope with the statement of what your true life potential, what the path you should be on, where you should be heading.
Yeah, so picture, if you will, your classic kind of small town store, whether American, Irish or otherwise, and a general store. And then one day, out of nowhere, this neon blue tinted machine, which looks like an arcade machine, just shows up out of nowhere. It's got a butterfly logo on it, and it looks very inviting. And if Sean Rocks was to step into it and give his personal information, it would dispense a card with either a single word on it or maybe a couple of those, which supposedly reflects your potential in life, what your destiny should be. So it might say broadcaster, it might say superstar, it might say hero, it might say villain. It could say any of these things. And this thing happens out of nowhere to the townspeople. And one by one, they begin to buy into it as if this is a sacred text.
Yeah, so it's all about, I suppose, the faith in that kind of, you know, where does the text come from? Where who is this authority that is passing on this information? For example, is it the principal of the school is told she should be a Harley Davidson rider, and she immediately gets herself a big motorbike and changes her whole modus operandi?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the most interesting thing about this show, apart from the whole, you know, well, what is this and where did it come from, which the show is actually less interested in, is the idea that the merest suspicion, the merest whisper of something like this can change your life radically. I mean, Chris O'Dowd's character, who seems to be very, very content when we meet him. He's just turned 40 years of age. He's happily married. He has a daughter with whom he's a good relationship. Mm. He's a competent, well-respected enough teacher at the local school. And all of a sudden, this thing just turns his life upside down. He's obsessed with it. And then when he gets his card, it further undermines him. And then he sees people around him getting, quote unquote, better cards. And it's just the idea that, like, on the surface, you're like, well, this can't be real. But they all are just driven mad by this thing.
So he's quite, the Chris O'Dowd character is quite worried about all of this. And he goes to speak at one stage with the priest, Father Raymond, played by Damon Gupton, about his concern for the machine and what it's caused, the trouble it's causing in the community. And here is their conversation.
Everyone who is trying, it seems to be making some pretty drastic life changes because of it.
It's weird.
Mm.
I just feel like I've already done my big life change. When my mother brought us from Ireland, it took a bit of getting used to, but I got used to it, and now I just want to enjoy it. This was it. This was the next chapter in my life story.
So you think a book only has two chapters?
No. No, not good books, anyway. But what happens next, then? I'm 40 years old. Weird shit has started appearing on my body. I could just drop dead at any minute. I have no discernible talents other than whistling. And I've only ever been in one relationship.
Yeah, me too. With God.
Ah. Right.
And that's Damon Gupton as Father Raymond and Chris O'Dowd as Dusty Hubbard. I must say, I'd love the name Dusty. Dusty Hubbard, the name of his character here. He's very likeable, Dusty Hubbard, and Chris O'Dowd is very likeable and easy to watch. I've only seen one episode, but he's an easy guide through, an easy to watch guide through this.
Yeah, I think he's very good in this. I think we all know him for his comedic talents. I think maybe the IT crowd was probably the first time a lot of us saw him, myself very much included. But he can do the drama thing as well, and this is a dramedy. I think it plays to both of those strengths for him. It's interesting because, as well, this is an Apple TV original show set in America, but you heard his accent there. He has his own accent. And there's a very quick line early on where he's like, look, when I emigrated from Ireland when I was a child, I'm like,
job done.
Done, perfect. You've nailed it. No, a lot of the show rides on him and your relationship with him. But like I say, as it goes along, like, his wife is just as big of a character. That priest is just as big of a character. Yeah. He's really interesting, by the way. And that actor is great as well. It is a very good ensemble. But I will say, yeah, Chris O'Dowd is one of those, and he's on the poster for this with a quizzical expression. You might be expecting something more slapstick, but I quite liked when he got to drill down into his insecurities. You're hearing them there in that clip.
Is there a touch of the Bill Murray about his look in that poster, and a touch of the Bill Murray face is kind of a downcast, not expressionless isn't quite the word, but deadpan.
Kind of hangdog, Bill Murray, well, I never even thought of it, but I think you're spot on. Yeah, and like, he's a very vulnerable guy, like this character, because he flits between all kinds of, like I say, insecurities. At times he's outright envious of people around him, but people around him, including a character called Giorgio, played by Josh Segarra, who is currently on the big screen in Scream 6, they're outright envious of his life and his wife, and they cover what he has. But it's all about the idea that in life, we're never truly happy, are we?
Yeah, so does it become that, I wonder, to what extent? Because the presence of the priest is kind of a points in that direction, certainly in episode one, that we're going to have existential angst here, we're going to have philosophical and spiritual debates.
Yeah, it kind of gets bogged down that on occasion, because each episode of the show is, and it's 10 episode season, the first three will be out when it drops next week, but each one focuses on a different character, primarily, kind of like the show Lost, but maybe not quite as exclusively.
Yeah.
I mean, like, everyone is kind of pinballing off of each other. They do raise those conversations. At times, though, I think they rely too much on a quick gag, a bit of easy comedy, a bit of levity. The stakes could have been a bit darker for me.
All right, let's listen to a clip where there's a touch of that kind of existential debate. Chris O'Dowd again, and he's talking to his high school class. They're all obsessed with what is the machine going to say to them, and this is what he says to his pupils.
No one who changed history needed a little blue envelope to tell them what to do. They made mission statements, and they believed in themselves. They worked hard in the steady pursuit of their goals, and they took control. They didn't throw everything away and just put all of their faith in some random outside force.
Excuse me, Mr. Hubbard. I don't mean to interrupt, but where are you going with this?
Yeah, it's kind of weird that you've, like, written this down.
It's called a lecture. I'm going to tell you where I'm going with this. I want everybody to pull out a sheet of paper. Can you do that for me? We're going to write two things on it. On one side, I want you to write, I am. And on the other, I will be. You're going to decide your own life potential, folks. What are you now? What are you going to be?
Well, what about you, Mr. Hubbard? What are you going to be?
Oh, that is the question, isn't it? That's a scene there from the Big Door Prize. Chris O'Dowd as Dusty Hubbard, the teacher who's saying to his pupils, not a bad exercise, I am, I will be. It doesn't have that feel-good aspect to it, because there really is a touch of it there in that scene.
Well, Dave. I mean, yeah, there's a bit of Dead Poets Society stuff there. Yeah. But again, we have to remember that the main reason he's doing this with his students and the future generation is to justify his own kind of, well, I didn't get the answer I wanted, so yeah. I will now try and corrupt everyone else. Or have, you know, like, is this machine corrupt at all? Like is it doing that to people around them? There is a feel good aspect to the show. Yeah, I mean, like I say, you know, in terms of stakes and kind of going to like maybe heavier places, it kind of avoids that a little bit too often at times. It can be a bit saccharine. You heard some of the music there. I do like the music in the show, though. It's a big hearted show. Like it is, it's not out to challenge you to that degree, but I think that that's where they kind of miss the opportunity.
Not the first time that I have said this about a television series, or indeed that people on your side of the desk have said it too. I watched the first episode, which was perfectly acceptable, but it was 36 minutes long. They could have told it in about 10 minutes.
Yeah,
a short scene at the top. Does it drag over the episodes you've seen so far?
I think so, yeah. I have watched the whole season, and we won't get into spoilers or anything, but I mean, I will say that like I think we are in this kind of strange era now of television where some shows want to spin their wheels, maybe because they have that eye on season two. I mean, you look at a show, a very different show, of course. We look at The Last of Us quite recently, and it was like, well, you really burned through all that material in one season. Maybe you could have spun that out to three. And in a way, it was admirable that they didn't. But now, I think that there's just such an emphasis on getting people hooked in, and we'll keep this thing going, which I think is to the show's detriment overall. Yeah.
All right. Well, remember Fawlty Towers. What did they do in a handful of episodes? Anyway, worth sticking with, yes or no?
I liked it, but I wanted more from it.
We wanted more from it. That's Dave Hanratty speaking to us about the Big Door Prize, the first three episodes of which are available from Apple TV from Wednesday, March the 29th, and then one episode per week thereafter. This evening's competition then, just as we finish up, we are giving away two tickets to Enda Walsh's new Electric Ballroom at the Gate Theatre with dinner beforehand at Restaurant 6. We were looking for the co-founder of the Gate, who we were speaking about in the programme last night. Micheál MacLeamore was the name we were looking for. Tonight's winner is Siobhan McNamara. Congratulations to you, Siobhan. Enjoy the show and the dinner beforehand. That's our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Kieran Dunn was the sound supervisor this evening. Broadcast coordinator was Stephen Higgins. And the programme was produced by Keshi. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1.